Hello, I'm Rich Kilgareth. Welcome to Bookomi. Whether you're leading a company, a team, a family, or just trying to lead a better life, I want to bring you original, memorable insights, or OMI, from books by the most wanted minds in nonfiction today. So even if you don't have time to read a book a week, you can still shine a wider light on who you are and what you do for a living by listening to Bookomi. If you're inspired by what you hear and you want to go deeper into the subject, you can buy the book in our club shop. Just follow the link in the description of the episode. Visit bookomi.com for more details, where you can also sign up to our weekly Most Wanted newsletter. Every week, I ask someone at the top of their industry or profession to pick a book from our Most Wanted list, and then I interview the author to share some of their original, memorable insights, or OMI, from the book. Hence, Bookomi. This week, our guest leader is James Sproul, Chief Economist in the UK for Handelsbanken. James is also an honorary captain in the Royal Navy, so he knows a thing or two about keeping a steady ship in stormy times. Here's why he wants to read The Impossible Office, The History of the British Prime Minister, by Sir Anthony Seldon.
Well, hello, Bookomi. I was really, really privileged. In 2019, I ended up actually working for the Prime Minister in No. 10 Downing Street. And so I was to get a first-hand view of what it was like. And I thought there were a number of things that really struck me. Now, is this a job that's really possible anymore? Now, are the expectations so high? Is our society lost the whole idea of deference? You know, going back to even some of the post-war prime ministers, there was more respect for what we considered to be our betters. Clearly that's gone, and therefore keeping even the majority or even a large portion of the people happy a good deal of the time has become increasingly difficult. And I would really love to see what Anthony Seldon is saying about all of this. You know, has he looked into these really, really interesting questions about our society? This is not a question of the fact that Boris is a conservative or, you know, the next person might be Labour. This is, we'll face any prime minister from whatever party that it ends up being in power.
Thank you, James Sproul. The Impossible Office is a sweeping 300-year survey of the men and more recently women who have held our country's highest office through wars, financial crises and pandemic. From Robert Walpole in 1721 to present day with Boris Johnson, the people who we choose to lead us reflect not only the political climate of the times, but the personality of the nation and our business community as a whole.
Look, everybody's ambitious. For those listening who are in organizations, or maybe you're running your own organization, it would be totally natural for you to want to rise to the top of that. I mean, that's totally natural. It'd be totally natural to think that your company is better than anybody else's, or if you're within an institution, that you're actually better than the chief exec or the finance director or head of human resources, whoever it is. And if you go into politics, it's totally natural that you want to become prime minister. All the great prime ministers have always had a gravitas and a strong moral conviction and moral purpose, even if their own lives haven't been paradigms of morality.
Sir Anthony Seldon is the honorary historical advisor to No. 10 Downing Street and has interviewed just about every prime minister since the 1960s, informing over 40 books and his work across several educational charities and organisations, including the Institute for Contemporary British History, Action for Happiness, and the National Archives Trust. He's found time to share his OMI with us today. Sir Anthony, welcome to Bookomi.
Very nice to be on Bookomi.
Do you think James Sproul is right there? Have we lost respect for the office of Prime Minister?
Yes, we've lost respect for positions of authority in general. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Since the 1950s, a deference, a respect for elders and betters, often measured in a social class and power way, has declined. So children are less deferential to parents, particularly my own children. We are less deferential in society to those who have power. And we can pinpoint that back to the early 60s, birth of private eye, satire on television, Beyond the Fringe at Edinburgh Festival, Peter Cook, Dudley Moore. I mean, you know, a whole stream. And it's led to a questioning which is healthy and a cynicism which is not healthy.
Let's step back a bit before we dive right into it. Why do we have the Office of Prime Minister in the first place? I can see how it's evolved and how deference has changed because of cultural changes and relationships with authority. But how did it come about in the first place?
Well, because Britain had its civil war and its revolution in the 17th century when Charles I lost his head in 1649. The monarchy was restored, but with a diminished power. Again, it faltered in 1688 and a new monarchy came in, William of Orange and Mary. And again, the monarchy had less power. And Parliament had some of the power, and the monarch needed to be able to have their own person in Parliament organising votes to ensure that the monarchy could get the royal business through Parliament that it needed to have in the 18th century, and also to get the money that they needed. And so the new King, George I, turned to Robert Walpole, and appointed him, and they had a very successful relationship, and Walpole did the king's business and got the king the money and the votes that they needed, and the king gave Walpole the power that he needed. So it was a very symbiotically successful relationship, and Walpole serving 21 years is still the longest serving prime minister of the whole 300 years. Nobody has done it as long. I think I just mentioned there, Rich, that, you know, we tend to think that decline in deference is a new thing, but actually Walpole was mercilessly ridiculed in operas, which is the equivalent of Netflix of the early 18th century, in cartoons, in newspapers, and so was the monarchy. So whereas there was a new wave of scepticism, lack of deference from the 1960s onwards in Britain, it's always been there. So it's really been a secular move of pro and anti-establishment figures.
In the book, you list, so, I mean, some of the things that are eternal, the evergreen skills required of prime ministers through history, and you list those seven skills. A list that includes intellectual ability, but not necessarily a university education. How would you rank the intelligence of our current prime minister with that of other prime ministers in a time of crisis in the last 300 years?
Right. I think that we have to look at intelligence in a much broader way than we've been led to think about intelligence with IQ. And this is the bane of schools, that we measure somebody's ability in tests and exams by their very narrow definition of cognitive intelligence. And I say that, Rich, because there are other forms of intelligence, social intelligence, emotional intelligence, communication intelligence, which leaders in any profession need to be able to have. And Boris Johnson has those. I mean, he's a very gifted communicator, much more gifted than Theresa May, more gifted than David Cameron, more gifted than Gordon Brown, not as gifted yet as Tony Blair. So he also has a great ability to empathize. And it's key that the PM can tell a story, communicate a story, and is the national story teller for Britain. Intellectually, he has a very good, quick ability, but lower capacity at short-term analysis. He has a low boredom threshold, so contrasting very much to Thatcher, who would really get into the nitty-gritty of the detail. That bores him to tears. He likes to get things very quickly, likes to be verbally briefed, likes to be seen to be on top of a lot of areas. But when you probe down below the surface, as was the case when he was Foreign Secretary, people find that he hasn't got that detailed knowledge, as on Brexit, indeed.
And ruthlessness is also on the list. As an effective leader, where have prime ministers in history drawn the line between ruthlessness and cruelty?
Well, that's a very good question. You need to be ruthless because not everybody, not all your friends, or the people who've been on your journey on the ascent up to the top of the mountain will be necessary for you when you're on top of the mountain. It's a very different job governing to from number 10 to being on that long and very perilous journey up the cliff edge. And you need to be able to jettison those who are not going to make the cut. You need to be able to jettison ruthlessly policies, commitments that you've made to people. Cruelty is never necessary or advisable. All the great prime ministers have always had a gravitas and a strong moral conviction and moral purpose, even if their own lives haven't been paradigms of morality, particularly sexual morality, or indeed in cases, financial morality. But to have a strong moral purpose, and for that you need to be not cruel in the sense of many medieval rulers, or indeed figures like Vladimir Putin today. No, that doesn't fit in with the modern prime minister. So to be assertive without being aggressive, and to be ruthless without being cruel, are necessary skills.
I heard you say once, I'm pretty sure, that we have a tendency, and this is the headmaster in you speaking as well, I think, or was speaking, that we have a tendency to self-limit ourselves. In the context of the Prime Minister's office, it's not for underachievers, but Prime Ministers, as you point out eloquently in the book, are human beings. They bleed and hurt and suffer. Has there ever been such a thing as a happy Prime Minister?
Well, that's such a great question. It's common when you become Prime Minister and you walk down the long corridor in Downing Street, and then you close the door of the Cabinet Room, which is at the very end of the corridor from the black door that leads onto the street. The door closes and suddenly the reality sinks in that this is the most frightening job in the world. And it's very hard to do it well. Not a single Prime Minister has left since 1945 at a moment of their own choosing. They've all been scuttled out of office, and the pressures on you are so intense, and it's so difficult to do a satisfactory job. You are surrounded by critics on the opposition benches and in the media, but no critics are fiercer than the senior members of your own party, particularly cabinet. It's very hard to know who to trust, and even your friends, you might be relaxing at a dinner with your tie off if you're male, relaxing if you're Theresa May and Margaret Thatcher with old friends. But even then, there's a suspicion that you're liked and valued because of the job that you now have. It's very hard to be grounded, to know who you are. Most prime ministers don't know who they are in the job. They become overwhelmed by it. And leave with their ambitions ill-digested and only partly done. If they're all honest, I would say that Thatcher was certainly much happier as PM, particularly at certain moments when things were going well, than she was. She was never happy as a post-PM. Clement Attlee, the great Labour leader after the war, clearly did enjoy being Prime Minister. But the experience of most is that it's a very unsatisfactory experience for you, as well as for your spouse and your children. But that's not half as unsatisfactory as it is after you've been PM, when it's very hard, as David Cameron, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, Theresa May, John Major have found, to find any kind of settled existence.
And yet, despite all the historical precedent, people are drawn to the office like moths to a flame. And the way you describe being a headmaster, you were headmaster at Wellington College and until recently the vice chancellor at the University of Buckingham. You describe being a headmaster as the magician at the center of the ring. You're obviously very happy in that role and you dedicated your life to education and there was a sense of purpose in that. But with history in mind, how can we, you've got kids of your own as well, how can we teach kids about the past in order to help them understand the present and imagine the future when everything is happening so quickly to us today?
Well, we need to not get swept up in the ephemeral. We spend far too long absorbing the day-to-day headlines, and prime ministers do the same. They're reacting to the short term. So we're recording this on the day that Boris Johnson is trying to gain brownie points over the rearrangement of the top six Premier League teams in Britain. I mean, what is he doing in that? It won't end happily for him. What we should be doing with our school children, and equally what our prime minister should be doing, is looking at the big long-term currents of history and understanding what's happening in this country and in its relations with other countries at a much deeper, more fundamental level. Even at A-level and university, students study a terribly narrow piece of history that doesn't give them a broad sweep. I think that history is always important. Obviously, I'm a historian. I think that it's also very important, whatever job, if one has a job, people listening to this have, for those who will be most effective in whatever you're doing, having a longer term sense of perspective and having stillness and quiet and reflection time in your work. Look, we kid ourselves, Rich, most of the time. We kid ourselves that we're doing a good job as parents or employers or leaders or members of our churches or whatever communities we belong to. In fact, we don't stand back and look with a detached, more objective eye nearly enough at what we are doing, which is why I've always been a big advocate as a head at Brighton College and Wellington and teacher before and vice chancellor and la la, you know, to have young people embedding the practice of self-reflection, quiet time, contemplation, honesty with oneself, so that we can live our lives in tune with deep values rather than with the ephemera buzzing around on this day's gossip or this day's headlines, which is always changing, rather than living on the surface of the water, constantly being bobbed about. We should be plunging deep down into the depths. And that goes for us, whether we're prime ministers or parents or whoever we are.
Is it even possible, though, to have a conviction today, or to be a conviction politician, as we used to call them, and rise to power? Surely part of rising to power is moving with the ebb and flow of social media and 24-hour news.
No, I don't agree with that. I mean, look, everybody's ambitious. Whatever, for those listening who are in organisations, or maybe you're running your own organisation, it would be totally natural for you to want to rise to the top of that, or to make to double your quadruple your market size. I mean, that's totally natural. It'd be totally natural to think that your company is better than anybody else's, or if you're within an institution, that you're actually better than the chief exec or the finance director or head of human resources, whoever it is. And if you go into politics, it's totally natural that you want to become prime minister. Those who make the most success are those who are in touch with not the short-term eddies on the surface, but with the deep reservoir of the current, the gravitas, the substantial movements in history. Those prime ministers who've made the most difference: Margaret Thatcher, Clement Attlee, Winston Churchill, Lloyd George, Gladstone, and going back beyond them, were the people who were not just reacting to next the next day's or today's headlines and constantly in reaction mode. They were describing, they were agenda setters, they were history makers, they were the change agents, they were the people who were giants in their own day, precisely because they were not just flitting around on the surface. There's far too much flitting around on the surface in politics today, with fairly insubstantial people trying to think that they're great and they're not.
You say the Prime Minister has considerable power and surprising freedom. They no longer are just first among equals. Over the past few years, we've seen the power of the Prime Minister and the Cabinet stretched to meet the political ends of both Labour and the Conservatives. What role has the monarchy played in tempering that power through the years? And how do you see that changing in the future?
Clearly, we're recording this just after the death of the Duke of Edinburgh, which is a moment of real pause and national reflection. From the abdication, 1936, the Second World War onwards, power has effectively been in the Prime Minister. But it's not as if the monarchy is without power. The monarchy, as we saw with the Queen and with Prince Philip's death, has enormous symbolic power, and not just in Britain, across the Commonwealth. It's the monarch who the Commonwealth Prime Ministers want to see, not the British Prime Minister. One reason British Prime Ministers don't like the Commonwealth very much is because the Commonwealth PMs look to the monarch, they don't look to them. And therefore they've neglected the Commonwealth more than they should have done. The question, obviously, Rich, is what then happens when Her Majesty dies, and will Prince Charles be able to keep the authority of the monarchy going in the same way that his mother did? And nobody knows the answer to that question. But I can't see myself, Britain, becoming a republic, because being a republic would mean you then have an elected head of state, as in America or in France. And that means the PM would then lose massive amounts of power. So I can't see any of our current political leaders wanting that to happen, when they all aspire to being prime minister and don't want somebody else to nick it in a job that they could never have the access to.
And power and the pursuit of power is always at the heart, obviously, of somebody who becomes the Prime Minister. When they get power, how much of an advantage is a big majority to the quality of their leadership? Or is it a disadvantage to have that too much power in terms of decision-making?
Well, it can be, if hubris is a real danger in any leader, from a vice chancellor to the Great Britain ladies hockey coach or manager to being PM. Hubris, we need to constantly be aware of. Great leaders always have people around them who tell them things they don't want to hear, tell them truths, and second-rate leaders surround themselves with people like them who flatter them to deceive. The danger's always there, but to have a strong majority is so important, because otherwise the PM fritters their time away having to see backbenchers. They really don't. They hate doing that. They'd sooner have all their teeth pulled out and spend time with their own backbenchers, frankly. Shame, but it's true. And the successful PMs in history have been there at times of great landslides. So to be a successful Prime Minister, you have to be in office for more than 5 years. Otherwise, you can't make a significant mark. Only one Prime Minister, Earl Grey, who was PM for 3+ years, did, with the abolition of slavery and the Great Reform Act. Everyone else has been there for more than 5 years. Everybody else has had a great majority. Everybody else has had a long apprenticeship. They've all had wars or crises that they've been able to champion. They've all had clear agendas. So those are the requirements to be a successful PM. And that majority is very important, very tough if you are Gordon Brown or fighting for a majority, or Theresa May after the 2017 general election, or John Major throughout his time in power, or Jim Callaghan after 1976. Very hard to make any kind of impact if it's a constant battle with your own backbenchers.
And Tony Blair shared the insight on being Prime Minister with you that paradoxically you arrive at your most popular and least capable and then leave at your least popular and most capable. Do you agree with that? Do Prime Ministers become more capable over time in office, or do they reach peak PM and then go downhill from there?
Well, he said that on the radio series, the PM at 300, which I presented on Radio 4. He's right about that, but he squandered the opportunity. He came to power in 1997 and spent his 4 years as if he was still campaigning for power and trying to tonk the opposition and show how wonderful he was, rather than with the cold, dry, drab business of actually getting on and governing. Therefore, when he came back in 2001, he recognised he'd largely squandered his first 4 years, came in with a serious agenda, realised that he needed to get on, but then suddenly 9/11 happened, and that distracted him for 2 years, and then he got involved in the Iraq war, which wasn't properly planned and followed through, which damaged him. And it was only in his last few years, when he had the least political capital, that he was at last serious about getting his domestic agenda sorted out.
You mentioned super teams and super leagues earlier. If you could pick a super team of three prime ministers from history, present and recent office holders excepted, to lead us through the next 5 years, through Brexit, through COVID, through climate change, who would those three be and why?
I think you would want the analytical depth and respect for science and truth and integrity of Margaret Thatcher. I think you'd want the ability to speak to the nation of Winston Churchill. And I think you would want the high moral tone in Britain and abroad of Gladstone, arguably the greatest intellect of prime ministers, and an absolute giant, four times prime minister.
Sir Anthony Seldon, thank you for sharing your OMI with Bookomi today.
Rich, really, really great pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bless you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sir Anthony's book, The Impossible Office, The History of the British Prime Minister, is available to buy now in the Bookomi shop. Just follow the link in the episode details. We barely twiddled the doorknob of number 10 today, so if you'd like to go inside and have a good look around the lives of the people who lived there since 1735, be my guest. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new non-fiction, sign up to our weekly most wanted email at bookomi.com or become a corporate member at bookomi.club. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Thank you for listening. And remember, you can change the wallpaper, but the office of the Prime Minister will always look the same from the outside. Bye for now.